All right, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The Next Thing!
Next Show!
The Next Thing!
Next Show!
The Next Thing!
Next Show!
Let's get down to business.
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
See, now here's the question, right? And I just noticed this. Does our announcer on the intro say from the Linux Link Tech Show studios with an S or without an S? Because if it's with an S, that's like completely appropriate at this point, right?
I think it's without an S.
We need to get a new intro made just for that.
Is it from studio? Sounds like studios from here, but, you know, I'm across the wire.
You know, I think it is Linux Link Studios.
See, that's completely appropriate.
I don't know.
Absolutely the way it should be.
Dan, welcome back to the show, man. We missed you.
You know, a whole one day, one episode. Thank you. I miss you guys, too. I tried to call in, but I was stuck in Ocracoke Island. There's absolutely no cell phone coverage and only one wireless hotspot on the whole island, which was nowhere near where I was staying. Well,
liar.
It was about 2 miles, but that's, you know, the island itself isn't that big. But enough about me. Pat, introduce our wonderful guest tonight. This is going to be exciting.
Sure, we have a fantastic guest tonight. We have Michael Shilo, who is the Community Developer Manager for the OpenMoco project. Michael, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So could you give us, for people who don't know, you know, for anybody who doesn't know what OpenMoco is, I'm sure there's a few still, could you just give us a little background exactly what the OpenMoco project is and what your role is there?
Absolutely. OpenMoco is, as we quote on the website, I think, it's an open source mobile computing platform. What we mean by that is that it's the software stack that's necessary to run on what we consider mobile computing devices. And that could be anything from a cell phone to a tablet kind of thing. We're really trying to aim at a sort of a generic, a general purpose definition so that it won't be limited to one particular device.
Oh, see, now that's completely different from what I thought. I was thinking, you know, you were doing some kind of reasonably priced open recipe for, you know, a hot chocolate beverage.
That would be Open Mocha.
Open Mocha or Open Cocoa.
Open Cocoa. It seems completely to be a product outpaced at Starbucks, I'm sure.
So let me ask you, Michael, where exactly along in the project are you? What stage are you guys at?
Well, it's been an interesting project. I should add that there are actually sort of two parts to this project and this company. There's the software stack, OpenMoco, and then there's the hardware that this can run on. Now, in an ideal world, this should theoretically run on any kind of hardware, the same way we're used to putting Linux on almost any kind of hardware. But as we know, it's hard to get Linux sometimes to run on specific platforms that have chips for which we can't run open source drivers, chips that either the data sheets aren't made available or the manufacturer doesn't provide open source drivers for. So we have exactly that same problem in the mobile computing world, and in the cell phone world in particular. So when we embarked on this project, we realized that we'd have to actually build our own handsets and carefully select chips that we could either get open source drivers to or that we could get the data sheets to and create our own open source drivers. So the Neo 1973 is the first handset that we've made that is designed to support the OpenMoco platform. But we do want to point out that the design of the OpenMoco software stack is not intended at all to be restricted to our hardware. But then you ask, where are we in this process? So we have the OpenMoco framework almost completely fleshed out. We have a number of the typical applications that you'd expect to have in a smart cell phone stack. Your dialer, your contact list, your calendar, your note taker, and of course there's an assortment of games already. They seem to pop up very quickly. There are pieces that don't work. It's very much a project under development. And then in terms of the hardware, we have our first rev of the hardware that has been made and is out in developers' hands. We consider it to be a developer-ready piece of hardware, but certainly not consumer-ready. This isn't a phone that you could carry around, that you could give to a non-technical person and expect them to reliably make phone calls with. So we consider it a developer-only release. Now, that particular phone had some disadvantages, so we decided to proceed right away with the second version of that phone to fix some of those bugs and also added some new features. So the second version is going to have Wi-Fi. That's the main big feature. It also will add a faster CPU, 2D and 3D graphic acceleration, and then fun little things like a pair of accelerometers, which allows you to detect if the phone is falling, for instance, but it also allows you to do things like gesture-based navigation. Now, that piece of hardware is still just about being finalized. We've done a few sample revs of that hardware in-house, worked out some of the bugs in that hardware, and we're just waiting now to finish a couple of drivers that will allow us to confirm the Wi-Fi connection and a few other things like that. The Wi-Fi connection is the big thing. Since this is the first time we put Wi-Fi into the phone, we want to make sure that we have the hardware correct before we mass produce it.
Now, the Wi-Fi portion, I guess that's going to be used for the online applications that you could use inside the phone, correct?
Well, in true open source fashion, it's really up to our inspired and creative community to come up with use cases for that. I mean, the typical kind of applications that pop to mind is you've got something that looks like a cell phone and looks like a PDA and has Wi-Fi on it. So if you're in an office or near a Wi-Fi hotspot, you can use Wi-Fi to do things like browsing the internet and logging into your mail servers and checking your mail and things like that, browsing the web. But if you're not near a Wi-Fi connection, then you could use the slower cell phone connection using GPRS and be able to do those same things that way. Obviously, that's just sort of the first typical application that pops to mind. But what people will actually do with it, the whole motivation for this project is to look forward to what kind of creative and innovative ideas the developer community comes up with once they have access to this kind of hardware and the open source that runs on it. And we don't know what they'll do. That's just part of the fun of this project.
Now, as far as the I'm sorry, Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, we had a question come in from our IRC. And they want to know, why is it called the Neo 1973?
Oh, that's an excellent question, and I did not stage that. It has nothing to do with the Matrix, contrary to popular opinion. 1973 turns out to be the year that the first cell phone call was made. I believe it was done by a researcher and inventor at Motorola. So we're referencing that, and then we've tacked on the prefix Neo, suggesting this is the new 1973. So to the extent that that first phone call was a revolution in telephony, we're suggesting that maybe this is the next step in that revolution.
Cool. Go ahead,
my question is, how far are you guys from actually having an end consumer device that's usable? It's a phone on a day-to-day basis. When I say, you know, usable, able to make calls, outgoing, incoming calls, you know, that are stable, voicemail, basic features, I guess.
Yeah, the basic features. That's actually your hesitation in defining it is part of the problem as we look at it. We say, well, what constitutes what do people expect from a consumer-ready phone? And everyone has a different opinion. Every one of us started off saying, well, obviously it should have this and that and that, and very quickly discovered that those assumptions are not at all commonly shared. But yeah, you could certainly come up with some kind of a set of things that most people would agree it should have. And we're not quite there yet on that. For instance, the dialer, actually, it's not just the dialer itself. It's the dialer plus all of the software underneath the dialer that's required to make the phone call. That is not working 100% reliably at the moment. You know, we're still chasing a few bugs and a few connections. And again, that's on the earlier hardware. So some of that, I don't believe any of that is due to hardware bugs, but we certainly have to make sure that works on the second version of the hardware as well. Let's see, other things like the calendar, the contact list, the notes, I think that's all pretty straightforward I haven't actually checked it recently, but I believe that is all there. But then there are things that you might consider sort of second tier, SMS. A lot of people consider SMS absolutely required. Is it absolutely critical, or can you go consumer without SMS? And then you get into slightly more difficult questions, which is, if we want to be able to actually compete in the consumer marketplace, do we need to have some new features that set us apart from the other sort of standard smartphones? And if so, what are those new features? Do we need to wait until the open source community, those creative people that I've mentioned before, come up with amazing applications? Or is it sufficient to go out with something that's sort of your basic four-function calculator, you know, the cell phone equivalent of the four-function calculator? And I don't know the answer to that yet. So when people ask us how soon until it's consumer-ready, I usually say that there are a number of stages in that. There's stable hardware, consumer-ready hardware, which we expect to have just about the beginning of the year. In other words, pretty soon. There would be stable consumer-ready basic functionality, which we don't have yet, and we've learned that it's very dangerous to predict when we will have things because we've been so wrong before. But sometime, you know, some handful of months after that. And then there's the question of sort of what then makes this stand out on the shelf at the various stores. And I don't know the answer to that yet either. Does that provide an answer to your question?
I guess, yeah, it does to a certain degree. I, you guys are going to get, you know, inevitable, you're going to get compared to the Apple iPhone. And I see these threads on places like Dig where, you know, the topic of OpenMocha comes up and people, you know, immediately compare it to the iPhone. And then they attack it. Oh, it's, you know, it's not ready for prime time, blah, 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 blah. It seems that most people, you know, not us in the Linux community per se, but, you know, just general consumers, they think, you know, it's the phone that's out and it's ready and it's out there already, and people don't have, you know, they don't know that it's just a developer platform at this point and that you guys are really building the whole framework from the ground up.
Yeah, you're exactly right. When the iPhone came out, I went through a period of resenting it because I felt that I was defending OpenMoco against the iPhone, while feeling inside that there's really no comparison. They're not in the same world. They're not in the same field. As you said, one of them is a platform, the developer platform is an environment, it's really more of a tool. It's like a research lab. And then the other one, the iPhone, is a consumer-ready phone with all of Apple's way of doing things behind it. But what I've learned over time is that the iPhone really has been an incredible sort of attention and publicity device for us. So it does give me the opportunity to explain what OpenMoco is, as I've done here, and then also to point out how different they are. Now, that works with developers. That works for people like you and people like your audience. It doesn't work for the average consumer. The average consumer is going to look at the iPhone side by side with OpenMoco, with one of the OpenMoco instantiations like the Neo, and say, you know, well, it does this differently, it does that differently, so and sort of add up all the check marks and say it's better or worse. So the consumer, I'm guessing, will be less interested in the promise of what OpenMoco might become. And they'll be more interested in just comparing it side by side to something like the iPhone. So that is definitely a big question, and which raises the question, you know, which is exactly the question I addressed when I said, how do you decide what is consumer ready in that context, in the context of how does it fare sitting on a shelf next to other phones, such as the iPhone. Fortunately, that's more of a sales and marketing issue, and that's an area that I focus less on. I'm more in the technical side of things.
I guess another big challenge is the fact that you guys are pushing to have this in so many different countries, and you know each country has their own regulations and laws. Now you have to pass inspection to get be able to use it. Which countries have there been the most resistance, and which countries, I guess, is it the most difficult to actually get it to get passed and accepted? I'm sure the United States is pretty high up there because they're pretty restrictive.
Yeah, that's another interesting question. There are a number of pieces to that puzzle. The first question, perhaps the first implied question, is how do you get to scratch build hardware and make it open source? And how do the cell phones, the carriers, allow you to hook up to the network? And the answer to that is that we have a closed, a sort of a black box, which is the radio, the modem, that actually talks to the cell phone network, that does the GSM connection and the GPRS connection. So that's the black box. And to us, on the open source side, it looks like a modem. It actually accepts the commands that are similar to the old Hayes smart modems that, you know, they saw with AT and various extensions after that. And the commands that black box exposes to us are certain restricted ones. So it makes sure that through the open source side, a malicious programmer couldn't do things like, say, sniffing other people's conversations or sniffing other people's ID codes and things like that, changing your power level, changing the frequency of the radio, shifting to another frequency. So all it lets you do is a limited set of things, such as connect to the cell phone network, send my identification, dial such and such a number. So the fact that was a black box is what enabled the cell phone providers to accept that. And then on top of that, you've got the regular certification that any consumer device would need, things like FCC certification that shows that you don't transmit a certain amount of RF noise that would interfere with other people's devices, whether they're phones or whether they're other things like TVs or radio. And then there are certifications for things like safety and what have you, and that's all very fairly standard. The FCC certification, the UL certification, I think Canada has its own, whose letters escape me at the moment. And how the rest of the world works, I'm actually not super aware of, but I get the impression that a lot of them simply accept the other one. So, for instance, the Canadian certification, I think, is actually accepted in a large part of the world. In other words, other countries, rather than coming up with their own rules, would say, well, here's the Canadian certification. It's all well documented. It seems pretty good. We'll just require that one. So that actually makes it easier for a consumer device. You don't have to get certification in every single country that you want to go into. You just need to get a certification that is accepted by those other countries. Now, that said, I think that we aren't in Russia yet, and I don't know if that's an issue of certification or if there was something else. And I don't know if Russia is the only country that we're not in, but I do remember a conversation about these matters, and someone pointed that out to me.
Speaking of countries that you are in, a few weeks ago, it came out that the frequencies that the Neo 1973 are supporting kind of are not what's being used in North America, particularly the United States. That seems to be like a huge blow for those
850 megahertz frequency.
For those interested in purchasing a Neo 1973 for use in the United States. Is there any plans to rectify that? Or could you explain what that's all about to our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, too, because it certainly was a big headache, and better to be able to address it. The problem there was that the radio, the GSM radio, the part that's inside of this black box that I was talking about, the chipset that does most of the functionality is capable of doing four different bands, the so-called quad bands, and let me see if I can remember them correctly, 850 megahertz, 900 megahertz, and then I believe 1800 and 1900 megahertz. And if you can cover those four frequencies, then you can work anywhere in the world. So from the chipset point of view, it looked like we were covered. It turned out that there were some limitations in how the chipset was how the circuit itself was implemented. In other words, how the chips were utilized, that limited it to three bands. And there were a series of things that happened that prevented us from seeing this until fairly recently. The end result of that is that the thing will theoretically, it can run any three frequencies, but you have to pick which three. And the reason the 850 was not included was, well, perhaps by coincidence, perhaps by virtue of the fact that it was designed in a country that didn't need the 850. So the bottom line is, the circuit will work with three different frequencies. The components that have been put down there are the frequencies that exclude 850. So the reason that's important is that it does mean that it is fairly straightforward to switch the components and have it work at 850 megahertz. Now, it's not absolutely a sort of a trivial thing. You do have to source those components. You do have to possibly redo certification. There's some calibration and firmware changes that need to take place. Nothing insurmountable, but stuff that does need to happen and does need to be tested. And does take some time. So the state that we're in right now is that we're going to test that 850 megahertz flavor, if you will, of that phone, and then that's one that will be available for North American customers And I think there are one or two other spots in the world that also use 850 megahertz.
Brazil, Argentina.
I don't know which ones off the top of my head, but I've been warned not to say strictly North America because then it makes the other countries feel, you know, ignored. I know that North America is not the only place that's using 850. So we're not going to, we can't promise that we can deliver this until we actually test it and make sure it works. But that is the path that we're moving towards. We're going to test it. We're going to see about getting all the appropriate, the other features, the other things that I mentioned, and then we'll be able to offer that as a variant. Now, we also know that further down the line, people really do want a quad band phone. People want to have one phone in their pocket they can travel anywhere in the world with and not worry about. Now, the engineering effort in converting this to quad band is much more substantial. And we're certainly looking at that for somewhere in the future, but we don't know exactly where. Did that answer that question?
Yes. But I'll tell you what I want in my pocket soon. I want a Neo 1973 because it looks awesome.
There is that. And I've got to say, every time I play with one and turn it on and play with the various applications on it. I mean, to geeks like us, the fact that you can, when you turn it on, you can see when you turn it on from a cold spot, you can see the typical Linux boot happening on the screen. You know, that alone is worth the price of admission from any of us. The fact that you can bring a terminal up on it, you know, the standard shell, and run command line applications. Furthermore, run all the typical command line applications that you're familiar with. You know, ls, cat, ps, df, all of those things are right there. VI comes with VI. Doesn't get much geekier.
The power of this phone is phenomenal, but here's a question for you that when we had talked about this a few months ago, because we're really excited about the Neo 1973. What's the situation with the phone carriers? How easy is it going to be to put this phone on the networks, the major providers? In the United States, we have AT&T, we have Sprint, Verizon. How easy is it going to be for us to just buy this and use that? And are those companies going to be, permit us to use the Neo 1973? Because I think, was it AT&T that, or was it Singular? No, Singular is AT&T. Verizon that said the other day that they're opening up their network to more capabilities and more products and third-party vendors and stuff like that.
Yeah, that was a very interesting announcement. That was just yesterday, I think, wasn't
yeah.
it? The day before.
No.
So, we'd like to think that maybe we were some part of some change of their part. Who knows? The question is actually pretty straightforward. There were two major systems, major cell phone technologies in the States. One of them is GSM. And the other one is, I forget the other one, I think it's CDMA. I should qualify that a little bit. At the sort of the slower level of speed, it is those two big things, GSM and CDMA. So of the four big major providers, AT&T and T-Mobile use the GSM system, and then Verizon and whatever the fourth one is, Sprint, use the other system, CDMA. It's a big enough difference that the phones are built either for one or the other. I mean, pretty much every phone out there has the hardware in it to support one or the other. So once you've built a phone with that hardware, it immediately says that you can only work with those two providers. If you're GSM, you're T-Mobile and AT&T. If you're CDMA, then you're the other two. Now, the nice thing about GSM, there are two nice things about GSM. First of all, it's the one that's supported by most of the rest of the world. CDMA is pretty much U.S. only. So that's one compelling reason to go with GSM. But the other one is the answer to your question. That is that with GSM, all of the secrets about who you are and what authorizes you to use the network and what identifies you and more importantly, who to send the bill to, is all stored on the SIM card. So if you can take that SIM card out of one phone and put it in another phone, as far as the provider is concerned, they're happy. You know, they know who to bill the calls to. They know that you're authorized to connect on the network. They know what features you're allowed to use and what plan you have and, you know, what kind of a data rate you've signed up for and how many minutes and all that. So by choosing a GSM radio and by being, which is SIM-based, we've gotten around that whole problem of how does the network allow us to access it. So from the network point of view, it doesn't really matter. They see your ID and they're happy. Now, the networks are also interested in trying to figure out ways to make money off of every single thing that you do with your cell phone. And it's conceivable that somewhere in the future, somebody will figure out some, you know, the so-called killer application to put on OpenMoco that uses some particular bandwidth, maybe it's a data rate, or I don't know what, either incredibly efficiently or for some absolutely amazing application that makes it very, very interesting. And the cell phone providers are going to try to, or will then be interested in sort of taxing that. Let me think of an analogy for that. I can't think of a good example off the top of my head. But it's conceivable that if something were like that were to happen, I kind of imagine this huge mission control that at the network providers where they somehow look at all the use of the spectrum and the frequencies and the bandwidth and all that. And at some point there's some big blip somewhere, some big blip in either a protocol type or you know, usage pattern, and they say, whoa, what's happening over there? Suddenly a lot of people are doing this one particular thing. How can we charge them more for it? And possibly if something like that were to happen, they might take notice. But for general everyday use, I mean, we do use the Neo as phone. As I said, it does have it does suffer the constraints of still having some problems. But we're already doing that. We're already popping our SIM cards out of our other phones, putting them into the Neo, and going ahead and making phone calls. And the providers don't care at all. They don't know at all. They don't care at all. Now that said, from a strategic point of view, we have made enough noise, or we've become well known enough, that a lot of the providers have actually contacted us and want to talk to us. And fortunately, I don't know anything about what those conversations have been about, because if I did, I'd have to say I can't tell you. But it is interesting. I think from the point of view of the visibility of OpenMoco, that those providers have actually expressed an interest in talking to us. I think that's a good sign.
Yeah, they're not turning around and basically shutting you guys out.
Exactly. I think that, well, I mean, if you wanted to be completely cynical and paranoid, then you could say that they're going to try to squelch this kind of a thing. But I also think that they see value in wherever we might be going. And if there's money to be made by following us or by working with us, they want part of that as well. And I guess it'll be up to us to convince them, up to us and then the open source community at large, to come up with the compelling reason that working, that playing with us, they can make more money than by excluding us or something like that. And then, of course, there are regulatory pressures. I mean, there was the issue with the FCC a while ago opening up some frequencies, and Google, of course, putting up that big hunk of money. I forget exactly how the details were. Encouraging the FCC, I think, to leave some frequencies open for make them more accessible. Now, that didn't directly relate to us and to cell phones. but it is the kind of thing that could conceivably change in the future. You know, the FCC could encourage or require the cell phone makers to change their rules.
Now, just a quick, just to go back to the frequency issue, 900 megahertz is available in the United States in certain areas, mostly in urban areas, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, I haven't actually. There is actually, if you follow the discussion, our community mailing list, I believe that on the wiki we actually have a map that shows where it is and isn't supported. The problem with 900 is it's a popular frequency for other things, such as cordless phones, I think baby monitors, things like that. So I believe the problem was that when cell phones came around, that frequency was already in use. And some areas just said, well, it's a small enough use, we don't care, we're going to go ahead and do cell phones at 900 anyway. And other areas said, no, we don't want to clash with those frequencies, so we'll shift it down to 850 and require that your phone can support 850. So yeah, it very much depends on what areas you're in, and it very much depends on what sort of hardware your provider is actually using. And I think that there's some complex relationship. I don't know if, and I don't know exactly how this works. You can imagine that up at the top of the cell phone towers, there's a whole bunch of technology, whether it's the radios and the computers and the interconnections between those things. I don't understand exactly if those are actually owned by the network providers or if they're owned by another party and then sort of leased out to the network providers. But it's up to that. It's up to the radios in those systems to figure out what frequency they want they'll be running at. And when some areas might say we'll spend the extra bucks to put in 850 as well, with other areas might say the number of users are too small. It's not worth investing in that additional hardware. I don't know exactly how that works, but it's conceivable that decisions like that are made.
You see, my fear is, this is definitely something I'm interested in getting down the road. You know, my question is, if I purchase, the next generation once it's released, will I be able to actually use it, where I live on a day-to-day basis? So,
yeah, well, one thing you can do is you can certainly look at those maps and see where you live. And I believe that on the wiki it explains it quite clearly and tells you how to go to your provider and figure out what frequency they're at. And it's also possible that some providers actually use different frequencies in different areas to figure all that out. But if you're really concerned, probably the best thing is to sort of wait and see if somebody else in your neighborhood gets it and then see what works for them. And as I said, we do intend to test this to try to make an 850 barrier. 850 megahertz variant of the Neo 1973.
I see. I'm looking at the wiki right now, and I'm looking under Singular. And you guys have all these different SIM cards, and whether or not they work with the Neo 1973. So I guess, like you described, the idea is basically you have a SIM card in your existing phone. You just pop it out of your existing phone, stick it in the Neo 1973. If it's on the supported list, and off you go.
Exactly.
So I guess the next release is what, the version 2?
The code words are GTA01 and GTA02. And what that stands for, I don't recall. But the first one that came out is the GTA01. And the one that we're working on right now and will have out at the beginning of the year is GTA02. And that's the one. And I guess the important distinction is the GTA 01 doesn't have Wi-Fi and doesn't have the faster processor, and GTA 02 does have those things, among other changes. In fact, if you're looking at the wiki, there is a page that has a nice little table and explains the differences between GTA 01 and GTA 02.
Now, the release
in fact, the wiki alone is sort of an interesting thing to point out because this is such a community-oriented project, in a way, the thing that's open about it is more than just the source code. You know, the documentation is open source. The planning and development. I mean, we sometimes jokingly say that we have an open source project. What's the word I'm looking for? Open source schedule. You know, there, some people were concerned that we couldn't give a date by when we would have things done. And the answer is that typically in formal engineering companies, you wouldn't even hear about the product at these stages. You know, this would all just be internal prototypes, and you wouldn't hear about it until it was 100% finished and debugged and ready to roll out. Whereas we're sort of throwing out our internal prototypes to the community almost immediately. The downside of that, of course, is that there are things that don't work, but the upside is that people get to participate in the development. They get to start working, getting ideas for their applications and working on those things right away. But most importantly, people in the community actually get to influence the design decisions that are made internally at a company. I mean, how often does that happen? Hey, let me give you a concrete example. When the first phone came out, the GTA 01, people started kicking around ideas. People outside of the company, community members, started kicking around ideas of what might be other fun things to do on this. And there's a huge collection of wish list icons on the wiki, some of them ranging from relatively simple and practical to completely wacky, and we encourage that. And a couple of the ideas that popped out were really good, and they were actually put into GTA 02. So, for instance, the accelerometers that I mentioned, the devices that let the phone detect if it's falling or if it's tilted a certain way, those were suggestions that came out of the community. It wasn't anything that the company internally, there was no market research that said, oh, we should have accelerometers, or there was no engineer inside that said, this would be a good thing to do. It was purely from the community, and we looked at it and said, yeah, that's a great idea, let's stick it in.
The big thing is you guys have lifted the veil on the whole development process from start to end.
Exactly. So the price you pay for being part of the development process is that you see a lot more of the blemishes along the way. But that thrill and opportunity of being part of the development process, I think, is absolutely unmatched. I mean, this isn't going to stop. So if you take that little example of the accelerometer that was added to GTA 02, just imagine the kind of feedback that can happen in the future and how that will influence future products that OpenMocha will make. So if the community comes up with an idea for an amazing application, but it's missing a particular hardware feature, we will seriously look at adding that into some subsequent device. Because we want to enable those amazing applications. We want to enable the kind of applications that will happen in the future, as I said this before, that we can't even imagine now. And if that requires specialized hardware, then we want to be able to do that.
Now, one of the things I noticed is that I read that Qtopia, which is the embedded framework from Trolltech, was ported over to the Neo 1973. Now, that framework seems to be a little more mature because it's been around a lot longer than OpenMoco. I guess it's just given more choice and more options to people who want to run the hardware as far as the applications and the toolkit that you're running.
Right. And since you brought that up, might as well toss out the other elephant in the is it elephant in the closet? Is that the expression? The elephant in the room, and that's the Google initiative, Android. There's been endless discussion about those in all quarters, whether it's on a community mailing list or people chatting in person. But the bottom line is that we feel that this kind of diversity is incredibly empowering. It's having that kind of choice, having the ability to have different types of software running on the hardware, having being able to pop in and out different pieces of the software stack. This is exactly the kind of flexibility that we think drives that innovation. So we work with Trolltech. I don't know at what level we talk to Google, but I know there's interest. I think it's wonderfully empowering to see those kind of things. Trolltech, as you said, is more mature. It's been around for longer. It's more polished, and it's great to see it running on the Neo 1973. There was a train of thought that I was going to mention, but I forgot. Oh well, it'll come back to me later on.
Well, back to the Google initiative. There are a couple of things that really jumped out at me. One of the things is you can own it. It's not quite Java, but it is Java. It's kind of like a variant. You can't use any C++ or C programs. You can only stay within their framework. And the other thing that really jumped out at me is these guys just have so much money to pump into this. And obviously they have, you know, a lot of people working with them, you know, in the industry, because it's Google.
Right.
You know,
right.
So you guys have a much tougher hill to climb, just for the simple fact that you don't have, you know, the vast amount of money to throw at developers.
Right. We don't look at it as an adversarial relationship. We don't look at it as we've got to conquer Google. We look at it as that there are different things that we're trying to accomplish, and there's room for both of us. As you pointed out, it's a very the Google initiative Android is very specific. It has that Java-ish feel to it. The licensing is extremely different. The way you would put applications in I'm actually not intimately familiar with Android, so I have to be careful of what I say here. But yeah, as you say, it's very, very different. So there are certainly people that will prefer one and prefer the other. And we believe what is motivating us is trying to enable people to be innovative. And we think that the best way to do that is to be as open as possible. So that's why we chose the licenses that we did. That's why we chose, we required that the hardware be, had the ability to have open source drivers. That sort of is what drives our decisions in choosing how we move forward.
Well, one of the big things about the whole OpenMoco project is you guys are really, really, you know, challenging the status quo, especially here in North America, as far as what you could do with a platform. To me, it's revolutionary, really. If you guys pull this off, it's going to be huge.
Well, that was exactly the thought that went through my head when I stumbled into the little sentence about this, about a year and a half ago. Like me, you probably get hundreds of newsletters every week. Maybe you probably even get more. With all sort of announcements about all kind of projects and new products and initiatives and God knows what else. I can only have time to open a certain number of them, and of the ones I open, I only have time to actually read through each one of only some of them. And I somehow stumbled into the OpenMoco one, and immediately the thought was what you just said, is that this could be huge. And that's what motivated me to get involved with the project, and now I'm proud to be a part of the company. It is incredibly exciting. This has the potential of really changing the way things are done in the mobile computing space and in the cell phone space. one of the things that I say is that this could usher in the ubiquitous computing era that people have been talking about for some time but hasn't quite been realized. I was talking with a friend last night about smart fabrics, which are fabrics that have defining smart in various different ways. Sometimes it's a physical property, but it also includes having electronics sort of as part of a fabric. And I started thinking, wow, what if you could integrate that with OpenMoco somehow? You know, what if it wasn't a cell phone that you were carrying, but something that you were wearing, and it had internet connectivity and GPS for location awareness? What would you do with that? I can't even imagine what you would do with that, but the potential seems huge.
It's a nice picture.
It's pretty much, you know, limitless what you can do. It's pretty much what you can think of in implementing it.
We're limited only by our imagination, which is why I'm so anxious to see people joining the project that have many different backgrounds and interests and disciplines. You know, if all you have in the room is a bunch of cell phone engineers, then they'll kind of think like cell phone engineers. You'll end up with cell phone type of results. But if you have in the room people who are artists or musicians, people who work with say fabrics, or people who work with medical devices, farm equipment, I'm just kind of coming up with random ideas, spanning a whole range. And you can see how their way of thinking, the direction that their creative process might go, would be very different. And one of those might just be an incredible idea. Well, I'm sure there will be. I'm sure there will be many incredible ideas.
So you talk about people joining the project. What are some of the areas that you're looking for help in?
Ah, that's a good question. I should have prepared for that. To answer the simpler aspect of that first, how do people join the project? And actually this is a good opportunity for me to say that there's no formal membership or qualification that one has to undergo. And this was actually another one of our important decisions. We didn't want that There's no NDA, there's no qualification process. You don't have to prove that you're a developer. You don't have to prove that you've done any big open source project. Anyone can be part of it simply by getting involved. Getting involved can happen a number of different ways. We have a number of mailing lists. Probably the most important one is the community mailing list. We have a wiki. And in fact, everything comes out of the website openmoco.org. So that's quite the place to start, and from there you would get pointers to the mailing list, to the wiki, and just find the area that users or interested new members might just find the areas that they're interested in. So whether it's the GSM radio, they might join the mailing list that specializes in that. Whether it's the kernel, they might join the mailing list in that. Whether it's applications or alternative input devices, or things like SMS or social networks, and I don't even know if we have a social network mailing list, but you know, there would be an area that one could go in that, and if it turns out that we have enough people talking about social networks, maybe we do need to create a mailing list just for those. The point I'm trying to get across is that there are many, many different areas that people are working in. In fact, going back to something I said earlier where I mentioned it's interesting to have artists and musicians being part of it, we do have those involved in the project. I remember a long time ago someone very almost apologetically joined the mailing list and said, I don't program, I don't know what I can contribute, I'm just a musician. And people immediately jumped on him and said, make ringtones. It's so obvious, you know, any kind of creativity can be poured into this project. So where are we actually looking for participation? And that's the part I meant that I should have prepared for. I can't think of any specific thing that we're looking for. Where this whole process of development in an open source way is kind of a new world, and we're trying to figure it out just as much as perhaps you are in asking these questions. How do you involve in a community in a way like this? It's one thing to have an open source project, something that's posted at SourceForge and people can contribute to, but having a whole company, a whole product designed this way, it's kind of a new thing to us, and we're kind of learning as we go along. So an awful lot of this thinking actually happens on the mailing list. People actually talk about how does this work. And like I said, we're learning as well. So I would say that for anyone who's interested in learning, anyone who's interested in joining, don't think so much in terms of what do I know that can be helpful. But think more in terms of what do I like to do, and jump on in and start coming up with ideas, and you'd be surprised where it can go.
To me, one of the areas any open source project really needs help with is documentation. And I'm very glad to see that you guys have a wiki, and it seems to be pretty up to date. I think you know, having good up to date documentation is key.
I think that's a really good point you make, I'm pleased that you think the wiki is up to date and well documented. Perhaps I'm aware of how much of it is out of date and not well documented. And it's actually one of my responsibilities, so perhaps, which is why I'm especially, you know, it's weighing on me. The wiki needs work, absolutely. And we've benefited from an awful lot of community members who have been extremely helpful in putting information there. And what we're lacking is someone to go through and sort of rationalize it. There might be duplicated information. There might be information that's old. There might simply be too many pages in order, you know, making it difficult to navigate through. So that's something I need to do. And I guess if that is an area, if somebody feels like organizing a wiki, they should definitely contact me. But yeah, you're right. Documentation is really key, and the community has really been helpful here. A lot of the translation came all from the community members. I believe that we did either none or extremely little translation. And like Wikipedia, we now have a large number of languages that we support in the documentation on the wiki. But there's always room for better and more documentation. Another area that I think is one that I would like to see more development in is sample applications. Not just applications that are innovative and amazing or you know, just practical, but applications that can just show new users another way of doing things. Not new users, new developers, another way of doing things. So if it shows how to use a library, or if it shows how to use the screen or the keyboard or the speakers in different ways, any kind of application that does that just decreases the limitations for new developers to get involved. And I think that that's something I'd like to see a lot more of. That's something I'd like to do if I have more time, but since I'm a bit limited there, I'd love to see the community do more of that. I also think it can be fun because if I'm tossing out there the idea that you can write an application that doesn't have to be practical, kind of allows you a lot more creativity there, a lot more flexibility.
Very cool stuff. Michael, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, and we wish the best to you and the Open Mocha project.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. It's been a real, real honor, and thanks for your support.
Yeah, thanks Maybe for clearing up all this stuff, and you know, I'm really, really looking forward to when it's released for the general public, because I think it's going to be a fantastic product.
Yeah, maybe you can come back and give us an update.
I was just going to say, why don't we make plans? Excuse me, to talk again then, and I'll certainly look forward to reporting on the revolution then.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. You have a great, great week and upcoming holidays.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for your excellent questions and your support.
Oh,
take care.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Good interview.
Thank you, Link.
Yes, it was.
It was good speaking with you tonight. We'll catch you next week.
Okay, good night.
Thank you, Alan.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, good night, Michael.
Good night.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, guy. It was really, there were great questions. I really appreciate it.
No problem. And you know what, Mike? If you wanted to stay on, that's fine. We're going to go on to other topics. We're not kicking you off or anything, but it's completely up to you.
You know, I might just this is streaming on the on your station, right?
Oh, well, it's
streaming live.
Yeah. If by our station you mean the internet, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? I have a question for you, Michael. Aside from working with the Open MoCo project, what else do you do?
Well, Open MoCo is my full-time job right now.
Right, but I mean, do you do? Do you do other? I mean, like aside from the Open MoCo project, you being your full-time job. I mean, do you hack on other projects or anything?
Yeah, I'm involved in. I actually come from. On the one hand, a very sort of a traditional engineering background. I've done hardware and software and embedded system design for about 20, 25 years now. But then I'm also very much involved in the art and technology scene in San Francisco. Where we have a lot of that going on, so things like robotics for as art or machine performance art. All kind of hacking on machines and equipment, and sometimes with incredibly esoteric technology, and other times just for very simple stuff. But I really feel like that's kind of opened up my mind to a lot of potential possibilities. It really helped me think outside of the box. That freedom to not have to be practical allows you to be much more creative. And then very often out of those impractical, silly ideas, you get some idea for something that really is practical.
Now, how long have you been involved with the Linux community or, you know, just the open source community in general?
Let's see. I first heard of Linux. I was at Wind River and I needed an X server at home. Someone said, why not use Linux? And that was, goodness, I can't remember. It's got to be about 15 years ago now.
So you're an old hat.
It was, I'm sorry?
So you're an old hat then.
Yeah, this is back when you installed Slackware with a set of about 40 floppies.
Yeah.
You can imagine that.
The old days, yeah.
The old days, yeah.
So now, do you still run Linux as your main platform?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So what are you running?
Let's see. I'm running Gentoo on my email and web server, and then I'm running Ubuntu on my laptop. And actually, I guess all the rest of my machines are running Ubuntu. It's perhaps not the sexiest one, but it is the one that comes closest to it just works.
Now, are you running Gutsy?
Is that 7.10?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm running Gutsy.
Now, did you have problems running Gutsy, getting Gutsy installed on your systems?
No, not really.
And
in fact, I have it running on a couple of old laptops for my daughter, and I really didn't think that they would take it, and she really abuses them, and they seem to be fine. What sort of problems do you think are you talking about?
No, I've had absolutely no problems installing Gutsy. I mean, aside from a few quirks that were my own fault, it's been a pretty smooth process, but I hear a lot of other people complaining, particularly three other people on this show who I will not point out or name names, but my Gutsy process on three of the machines that I've been playing around with it on has been pretty much smooth. And there just seems to be an awful lot of people out here complaining about their gutsy upgrades or installs from one way or another. But eventually they get it on and like it.
Well, I upgraded four machines, and the only machine that I really had problems with was my laptop, which is a really junky laptop that I have. Other than that, you know, my other systems, they all upgraded really easy.
Yeah, you know what it probably boils down to is exactly the reason that OpenMoco had to build its own hardware, which is you've got a laptop with some piece of hardware in it that isn't well supported in the open source world, and there's some hacked together driver that's either reverse engineered or, you know, built out of source code that was not documented, and things go wrong. I would guess that's where most of the problems are. I mean, I have a ThinkPad, and I believe that the biggest problem on the ThinkPad is usually caused by the video drivers, the video chip, because they're usually not open source, or they run unlimitedly.
Yeah, most of the time with laptops, it's the wireless cards that give the most problems.
Oh, okay, exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. One of the reasons that the first Neo didn't have a wireless card in it was that we couldn't find one that we could get open source drivers for.
Well, one of the good things with a lot of the laptops I see, it seems that there's becoming a more of a standard hardware set. Like, I see a lot of the I'm researching a new laptop purchase myself, and I've been looking around. It seems a lot of them are favoring the Intel X3100 video chipset, which is a very good chipset, and it's completely, you know, open, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's always going to have the challenge in the laptop that the manufacturers want to squeeze the most amount of features into the least amount of space and, you know, the lowest amount of power and... you know, they're much more constrained than they are with a desktop where if it was another watt or something, it wouldn't make a difference, or another cubic inch, or, you know, that kind of stuff. And then all the more so in cell phones.
Yeah, with cell phones, it's crazy because a lot of the providers, they lock out features, disable things.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean it's always... As a hardware guy, I know there's always that question: do you use chip number such and such that's well documented and opened and worked well before and everyone knows it, or do you go with this new one because it uses slightly less power, it has some slight improvement in some other way, and at the risk of having to learn an entire new architecture and having to port all of the code that you have.
Well, let me ask you, Michael, as someone who's done embedded Linux development, what do you recommend as a tool set to learn for somebody who's trying to get into it? Do you recommend VisiBox? You know, I know there's all different vendors that have their own toolkits.
I generally like to stay away from vendors. I love VisiBox. I've used that on a number of projects. And it's just so straightforward. And it's pretty mature also. I mean, OpenMoco is based on VisiBox.
So you recommend Open... So VisiBox, you think?
I like VisiBox. You know, for learning things, I want to find the simplest thing I can. And VisiBox fits that for me. Actually, what I should really say is probably, for me at least, the best way for me to learn something is for me to do something that I'm having fun doing or want to do. So for instance, with VisiBox, I didn't set out with the goal of learning VisiBox, but rather I was doing a robot project and wanted to get a pretty slim Linux installation and discovered that VisiBox was a good way to do that. so far. I was learning about BusyBox in the context of building the robot, and that inspired me to, you know, stay up late nights and read those BusyBox as much as I did. But that's just me. I need that extra motivation. I know that some people are much better about setting out a goal of just saying, okay, I'm going to sit down and read the BusyBox book and just learn everything there is to know about. I need the project to give me that motivation.
Hey, I find it easier to learn things instead of just reading about them and studying, to actually have a project. That helps an awful lot. That's why it was so easy to learn Linux. Figuring that, because with Slackware back in the day, yeah, and even Slackware today, you still have to do a lot of tweaking, but not as much, because the kids these days, they have it easy with their Ubuntu's and their Fedoras, and they just slap it in and go. Well, back in the day,
yeah,
you had to work for it.
No. Get off my lawn, kid.
That's right.
But that's okay. I get a kick out of watching my daughter customizing her desktop with Ubuntu, and not even aware of, well, she is aware of it because I make a big deal out of it, but not at all missing the fact that that she's not using Windows, that almost everybody else in her class would be using. I'm indoctrinating the next generation.
And that's important. It's always good when the whole family runs a variant of Linux. It just makes everything so much more harmonious. And it fills you with that little bit of pride inside. Right, Alan?
Someday we'll have stickers on our doors that say this is a Windows 3 home, you know?
Well, I would be proud to stick that sticker on my door because there is no Windows here.
Well, there you are, yeah. I like it.
That's it.
Maybe we should see if the domain is available or something.
Yeah. And you know, it's great because I take it that you, at OpenMoco, do they do all their development inside of Linux? I would say you probably do it, if not in that, what is it? You guys had an image.
Open Embedded?
You had an environment. Didn't you have an environment built that people can... Instead of having to buy the developmental Neo 1973,
we have Open Embedded. There's Moco Make file. Is that what you think? No,
I can't remember what it is. So don't you have like a?
We're not using Eclipse. If that's what you're thinking of.
No, don't. Do you guys have a virtual image of it? Don't you? That people can.
Oh, like VMware.
Yeah, isn't there like an image out there of the Open Moco environment that they can develop in?
Well, we have an emulator.
That's what I'm thinking of. You guys have an emulator. Now, right.
So QEMU, I don't know how to pronounce it, and XOO, both run OpenMoco just fine. And we use that, and we use, just most people just use straight-up Linux. There are, sadly, a couple of... some of the stuff that we need for dealing with the GSM radio is only available on Windows. But since that's internal only stuff, it's not a concern. I mean, we resent it, but it doesn't go out. And then, of course, some of the support staff use Windows for as their desktop machine, email and spreadsheets and what have you. I don't know. My philosophy on Linux is if you hit people over the head too much with it, then they'll start resenting it and they'll kind of fight back even stronger. I think the gentle approach is usually makes for much better conversion.
It's when you keep hitting harder until there's nothing left.
I mean, one of my most successful conversions was a friend of mine who came to me one day and he said, I'm sick and tired of all the viruses that come with Windows. Is there anything I can do? And I just handed him a with your CD, and every time I see it.
Dan, are you killing your kids in the background again?
No.
Beating them.
Oh, hold on.
Beating them into Linux, huh?
Yeah, that's the way we do it. Every night, they go to bed with this big penguin emblazoned on their wall like Big Brother, and it just stares at them as they try to sleep. And every so often, we come by with, and the image will switch to, like, the Windows logo or Bill Gates, and we go in there, and we hit them with a baseball bat.
Fire up the chainsaw when it does that.
Yeah, that's it. No, we would never hit our kids. I don't know what they're doing, but they're having a good time in the other room. They should actually
being
be
kids.
They should be in bed by now. Holy crap.
How old are these kids?
They're too young. They're 9. One's 9 and one's 6, and they should have been in bed a while ago. A long, long time ago.
Yeah.
Put them to bed, Dan.
Put them to bed. They like to push it as much as they can.
Especially when Dad is busy on the phone and
that's it.
And they can get away with it.
Yes, they can. They'll do whatever they can to get what they want. Well, you know how it goes.
Just wait till they're teenagers.
Oh, I can't wait. Then I'll have to worry about them not being home by 9 o'clock. Or whenever.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to worry about what they're doing on MySpace.
Ouch. Zanga.
I don't know, you know, MySpace. Is MySpace really going to be that popular in another 5 years, or is something else going to replace it?
Oh, that's a good question. 5 years is an incredibly long time in that world, isn't it?
True.
You know, but the issues that you have to watch out for will still be there, I'm afraid.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, right now we have... some of the issues, you know, we got to watch out. Of course, we have to watch out with a lot of those issues because they do go online. They like to go to, it used to be Neopets, and now it's Webkinz. And the other one is ePets is another one that they're starting to get into. And they go on there where they build their little pets up and do whatever their little pet things are that they do and have fun. And then their classmates and friends get online and... You know, you got to monitor because you don't. You know, I'm like, you know, if anybody ever tries to contact you and you don't know who they are and wants to be your friend, you come and tell me right away.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know who else is out there. But you know, it could be a scary thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the same time, you're trying to raise your kids in a positive atmosphere. You don't want them to be suspicious and distrustful of everyone they meet.
Uh-huh.
But finding that balance between being careful and not is such a hard thing.
Yeah, Link had to go through all that stuff a little over a year ago, didn't you, Link?
Yeah, and you never get rid of that stuff.
Yeah, I suppose in different ways it really... had nothing to do with computers. I mean, computers and the internet, of course, makes it easier and increases the volume. But I suppose it always was a concern of raising children.
Yeah, but that stuff never goes away.
Yeah. My point exactly.
See, they should
get older, they just become bigger problems.
Yeah.
Problems in different ways, you know?
They shouldn't have to monitor my kids. They should monitor my internet usage sometimes because some of those sites out there are terrible.
No, that would be
another
abuse,
few years,
then.
And they will be. Yeah. Well, I used to show my daughter Etherate because it's just so beautiful to look at. Are you familiar with that application?
No.
Etherate. What's it called?
It's a network monitoring tool, and it shows you what protocols are
Etherreal
on your. I'm sorry.
Etherreal.
No, Etherreal just spits it out to you in text, isn't it? I mean, it captures the packets and it decodes them and all that kind of stuff, and it can colorize them, but it's still text based, right?
Yeah, so. No. Well, there is a GUI interface for Wireshark, was what it's now called.
Right, right, Wireshark. But Etherate is different. What Etherate does is it gives you a visual representation of your network. You know, the different computers on your network are just little dots with their IP address. But then whenever a computer sends or receives a packet, then you get this cone of a certain color. The color represents the protocol. The direction of the cone shows whether it's incoming or outgoing. And the size of the cone shows how much data is being exchanged. So it's a visually beautiful display. It's just mesmerizing to look at. But then, of course, if you're looking at it, you can also see that, you know, you're going to YouTube or MySpace or whatever it is. I mean, I'm joking. It's not really. If you wanted to spy on someone, this wouldn't be the most useful thing to spy on. But it is. It's kind of funny that I was showing it to my daughter in the context of just an interesting visual display. But if she wanted to know what I was up to, she could always run that.
Cool. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I see it on SourceForge.
What's the name of that, Pat? If you see it on SourceForge, post the link.
Etherape. I have a link right here. I'll put it in the IRC.
Oh, okay. I know.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite network monitoring tools because I get the information. The other nice thing about that kind of visual stuff is, you know, your mind is much better at spotting anomalies, visual anomalies, than reading text. So, at various times when I've been suspicious of something going on my network, I'll just leave that running on my screen at all times. And if you suddenly get a big cone of a certain color where you don't expect it to be, it immediately stands out. You know, your eyes just kind of switch over to that instantly. Anyway, gentlemen, I think I need to get back to work.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael.
It's really been a pleasure, and I certainly look forward to keeping in touch with you and letting you know where it goes.
Oh, definitely. And we will be talking to you again in the very near future. I look forward
great.
To it.
And thanks again for really the great interview and the great questions and the great support and encouragement.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Okay, have a great holiday.
You too.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Good stuff. He was a great guy. It was nice that he hung around.
Very cool guy.
I like that. Now, where were we? Who's got what? Who just left, too? What was that?
I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm still here.
I'm here, too.
All right.
So, Dan, you have a problem with people bitching about Ubuntu? You can't have gripes against it?
No, you can have gripes against Ubuntu. It seems to be an awful lot of people complaining about it.
And the Negubuntus, right?
The Negubuntus, yeah.
The Negubuntuists.
The whiny Buntus and the complain Ubuntus. The bitch Ubuntus. Biscuit 198.
Biscuit
B-I-S-K-E-T.
Well, Alan was going to give us a summary of his Apple upgrades. Leopard.
Really?
Ooh.
You bought Leopard?
Apple-licious.
No.
What's wrong with you, Alan? Why'd you buy Leopard?
What's wrong with... Why didn't I buy it?
Why did you?
I don't feel like it. I didn't.
You liar. Pat.
The innovation of spaces.
Is he lying, Pat?
He didn't buy it. Somebody gave it to him, right?
I didn't do that either. Sorry. Can't help you there.
You're no fun.
Well...
You know what? Since I have something Linux related to actually say, it's nothing really new, but I'm giving a Digicam a whirl again on my for my picture photo management.
Why are you going back to Digicam, Dan?
Because of that screw up I had with F-Spot, that I lost all my tags.
You wiped out your database?
Yeah, and I it's been a while since I used Digicam. I started, when I really started using a photo management software, I started with G-Thumb, and I really liked G-Thumb. And then Digicam came around, and I was like, wow, the functionality of Digicam far surpassed G-Thumb. And I think it pretty much far surpasses just about any other photo management system out there. It's the capabilities of Digicam are incredible. And I liked it. But when I tried F-Spot, and after talking with Miguel and Nat Friedman, and they were really hyping up F-Spot, I gave F-Spot a shot. And I'm not saying, you know, anything bad against F-Spot, so to speak. I really liked F-Spot. It was fast. The tagging in it was primarily geared towards tagging, more so than G-Thumb and Digicam are. F-Spot seems to be built around tagging, whereas G-Thumb and Digicam seem to incorporate it. I thought that just, you know, the F-Spot was nice in being fast, but not as reliable yet as the other two. And that could be just because it's a little more immature. So I was using that for a while when the upgrade... I guess the version of F-Spot wanted an older version of SQLite, and I didn't realize that, and tried to update my database, and they said you should back up your database before you do that, and of course, idiot doesn't do his backups like he should, and blew it out, so that resulted in me losing all my tagging information and had to re-import all my photos. So they re-imported really fast, and I wasn't having, you know, too many problems, but I just got to thinking to myself, you know, if I have to retag all these files, why don't I go back to checking out Digicam? Because about 2 weeks prior to that, actually, not 2 weeks prior to that, it was right around, right after the Ohio Linux Fest, when I wanted to export my Ohio Linux Fest folders out to a web folder, and, you know, very easily, and it was a pain in the ass because the whole JavaScript control over the style sheet for it was mucked up, and that didn't work right, and I had to hack that, and just, the export features in F-Spot are not as as bountiful and as exciting as those in Digicam, with all the plugins that are in there. So, you know, coupling all that together, I figured I'd give Digicam another try. And so far, you know, I've been using it the past day, and I'm really digging it. I mean, Digicam, I'd like to say, has come a long way, but it was a long way from when I was using it before. I mean, it's just a little more polished, and I'm going to start checking out some of the other features, like creating a photo album, or a calendar, or, you know, I think you can export to a video or whatever, so, you know, slideshow video. So, you know, see how that goes. But now I'm back to tagging all of my damn photos. and for another problem I was having with F-Spot was the way that it would import. I would click on the import button after it would show all those pictures, and I thought I'd have to highlight them. And I click on the import, and it wouldn't do anything. So I click on the import again, and it wouldn't do anything. But then when I closed it, it would have imported the same pictures twice. But didn't really tell me that it was, you know, it completed the import. Because it pulls the photos up, it shows them in the display, and like most other programs that I was accustomed to, you'd either select all of them or select the ones you want to import and click import. And it would show you like a little progress bar. Well, F-Spot kind of reverses that. And it almost essentially has them all imported to begin with. And you just click the import button and they're already transferred. I mean, it happens so fast. Or it didn't happen fast. They already kind of automatically imported it and got it all ready while you were waiting for the picture thumbnails to show. Or something. I don't know what the hell they do. But it's backwards from the other systems that I was used to. You know what I'm saying, Pat?
I hear you, man.
No, you don't, because you don't use F-Spot. None of you bastards use F-Spot. It's just me.
I've used Digicam. I like Digicam for photos.
Alan uses iPhoto.
No, actually, I don't. I just use directories.
Ah.
I store them all in the directory and then use a quick view or something like that to look at them.
There you go. I guess you do the same thing there, Link, don't you?
No, what I do all kinds of different things. I used to use, I can't even remember, it was a Perl script I used to use.
Album, isn't it?
And I've used, yeah, Album. And then I used Picasa, and I've, you know, written my own shell scripts and all kinds of crap, so. Picasa's not bad either, you know.
So, I never really gave Picasa much of a chance. I tried it out for a little bit, but I don't know. So you give it the two thumbs up there, Link?
It's all right. It's not bad. None of them really do, you know, everything the way I want them to. I guess maybe that's just... I probably will never find something perfect until I write something myself, but, you know...
I don't know. What the hell? What the hell? You know, I gotta say, when I went to the hotspot on Ocracoke Island and fired up my laptop and pointed Wicked at the Wi-Fi hotspot, it was no problem connecting whatsoever. So, it's just great. All these wonderful devices. Oh, I know what else. Dave Yates decided on episode... congratulations to Dave Yates on 50 episodes to begin with. He's at 51 now. He did his first interview with Nathan Hale from Productive Linux. And I had never heard of the Productive...
From the car, right?
Yes. Fantastic job.
That's pretty impressive.
Yes, it was. Hats off to him.
That's skill right there.
And I had never heard of the Productive Linux podcast before, or even the website, so to speak. But I gave it a listen, and I really liked the Productive Linux podcast. I also was listening to Going Linux, and I really liked their podcast, too. Two fairly recent podcasts. Productive Linux is on episode 3, and Going Linux is, I think, I just listened to episode 18. But they've been around for a couple of months, and some good stuff. So Productive Linux.
There's also Fresh Ubuntu podcasts and Linux Basement.
I have not heard of Linux Basement. I've heard a little bit about Fresh Ubuntu, but I haven't pulled it down yet or added it to my list because I'm lazy. But with Linux Basement, where's that? Do you have the URL for that?
You can go to DistroWatch. It's on there. The podcast one.
Did you guys listen to the Lug Radio that just came out recently?
Nope. Not yet, anyway.
Yes.
They had said that apparently Linux format has a roundup of 6 Linux podcasts. And a review of them in issue 100. Issue 100 isn't out around here yet. I suspect we won't get it for another couple of weeks. I'd be interested in... is that your cat, Alan?
Yeah, it is.
To see if we even got on there. Or if we did.
I was thinking the same thing.
How much they tore us apart.
It would be interesting to see that.
I
guess it, they would like us more if we had someone with an English accent on the show every week.
I
used to work at the magazine.
Well, I don't know. I'd be curious to see what they have to say, because, you know, getting positive mail and getting hate mail is one thing, but getting a hate review has got to be, for hundreds of thousands of people to read, it's got to be two thumbs up.
Haven't read it.
Any PR is good PR.
Wait a minute.
Exactly. We'll take it.
How does Dave Yates know the answer? Both one and two.
He must have read the article.
How could he have read the article? How could he have read the article? It's not even out in the United States yet, as far as I know. And he's in North Carolina. He's more backwards than where I'm at.
You have issues with Dave Yates.
What?
You know, Dad? You have some issues with Dave Yates going on there.
What goes on between Dave Yates and I is between Dave Yates and myself. It has nothing to do with the rest of you. What happens in North Carolina stays in North Carolina.
I was going to say that phone call you left.
Did you drop by and say hi to him?
No, I didn't. I wasn't anywhere near him, as far as I know. He would have probably been a couple hours away from him. And Dave Yates lives in South Carolina, anyhow. I don't know.
It's all the same, damn it.
It's just one big Carolina. Dun, dun, dun. But, you know, a lot of good Linux podcasts. They're all really good. If only...
They're growing every week. There's a new one.
Yeah, if only Sean Parsons from Linux Box would come back, and if only Marlon Dunn would pick up the microphone again and do some more episodes.
Yeah.
And if only we'd have a new security mode. Yes. And speaking of that, I gotta get my lazy ass and finish up that Bash Potters editions I made, because I use it every day, and it's been working great for me. It does three different things. And I should just release it. Send it to you, Link. And then finish the other part. Because I'm too lazy. I'm lazy. And Dishwatch podcast. I like that a lot, too.
I'm glad that got picked up by somebody else.
Yes. Good stuff. So what else have you guys been doing?
I've been dodging stalkers.
How's that?
It's very weird, man.
It's not hard to find you, man. You're like the first link on Google is your phone number.
Is it really?
Yeah, you're not real hard to find. You're not one of those people who Google themselves very often, do you?
So who's your stalker, Pat?
I don't know, man. I get these guys calling up who, they kind of say, like, you know, they saw my blog and they're interested in the same things I am. And the first guy I talked to, I kind of just blew him off. And the second guy called yesterday, and he kind of had the same kind of spiel as the first guy. And he brought up, you know, am I interested in monetizing my website? So I don't know if it's just some company that's looking to put advertisement on websites. If that's the freaking case, you know, cut through the fucking bullshit and just say that, you know? Don't, you know, call me and pretend to like you're a fan of the show and you're not. You know, I'm a pretty approachable person. If someone who's a fan of the show wants to come hang out with me, I'm more than willing to, you know, hang out and have a beer with people. You know, I'm pretty sociable. But, you know, when you get these people who are trying to, you know, scam you and shit, you know, that pisses me off.
Where is Pat's phone number posted? I like it.
Just put the state after his name. You can do that with anybody. Just put the state after their name, and if their phone number is public, Google has it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be changing my phone number to an unlisted number.
Huh. I get LinkedIn is the first thing that comes up. for your name, Patrick.
Yeah, my number's not in there. My number is not on my blog. It's not on my LinkedIn profile. It's not in my Facebook profile.
But if you,
in the phone book.
If you put it, but yeah, because you're in the phone book. If you put your name down and then put the state after it, first thing that pops up is your phone number with a map to your house, by the way.
Oh yeah, here we go. I had to get rid of that other crap. What was that? What do I have
it
in there?
It works for everybody.
Wait, hold on. The
Google's
Experts Exchange crap, I guess. Yeah, look at that, Pat.
That's been like that for a long time, though. That's for...
Never noticed that. Let me see if my name
pops
up.
Lookups.
Huh. Come on. Not my name. My name doesn't come up. My phone number doesn't come up.
No, it probably hasn't been updated because I think your PA one would.
No, because I'm not listed.
No.
I'm not. My wife is. So you won't see me there. You'll see our phone number under my wife's name. It's not like I hide my phone number anywhere either. Pretty soon people from Nigeria will be calling Pat. Because he won.
No, I think I'm changing my phone number. I've been getting some other phone calls. Not quite as creepy as those two, but annoying to say the least. And I'm on the do not call list.
That doesn't matter. They don't care. Link, you worked for a telco company. How much do they care about the do not call list?
Do not call list means absolutely squat. I'll tell you why. First of all, there's a lot of unscrupulous marketing companies out there who don't care about the do not call list. Secondly, any company that you have ever done business with for any reason does not have to follow the do not call list. So if if you have a Sears card or something like that, and Sears hires out some telemarketing company to call you about mowing your grass or whatever the hell it is, that's perfectly legal, and you'll get phone calls for that. If you have some bank who wants to hire a company to call you and solicit you for mortgage stuff or insurance stuff or something like that, that's perfectly legal, and they can call you because you have an existing customer relationship. So there's just no way around it, and like I said, those are the good companies, the ones that follow the law, and you just could call from them all day long because of your existing business relationship with whatever company. And then, the opposite end is the unscrupulous companies who just don't care and will call you anyway. And then you have the, to fill in the gap, you have the political calling, which, of course, doesn't follow the do not call laws.
They're exempt from that. Yeah.
So, there's just no way around it. The only way around it is to have an unlisted and unpublished number and don't give it out.
Yeah.
It's a shame that it has to come to that,
But it doesn't.
I just never answer my phone.
That works too.
Yeah, you know what? We have the phone for one reason and one reason only, and that's because we have an old TiVo, and that's how it updates its information. So we basically... We sit around and we say, why the hell don't we turn the ringer off the phone? Because we never answer it. Because anybody who's going to call us is going to call our cell phones.
There you go.
And if Link tries to call us, we have his number blocked.
Yeah.
It's that guy again.
It's that freedom hater.
Freedom hater!
That's me.
Ay-yi-yi-yi-yi.
So what do we got to play us out tonight?
I don't know. I didn't get anything.
I didn't pick anything. So.
You know, I'll play us out with something. I'll play us out with
him. Oh, no.
Dan's going to say it's jazz and it's like death metal.
No. I'll play something from the web.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Let me pull it down first.
This is episode 221, huh? Wow.
So you guys running out to go get your Nokia 810s?
No money.
Yeah, pretty much the same here.
Everybody's tapped.
Holiday
Christmas
season,
coming up soon and stuff, you know.
Yeah, the cheapest price I saw was buy.com. I had it for $429.
I really would like to get one too, but you know what? Just can't make it work right yet. However, I'm really looking forward to the OS 2008 coming out for the Nokia N800.
It's out already, isn't it?
The beta is. I'm talking about like the real actual release next month.
La 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 la
la. Bum, bum. We'll play out to the sound of crickets.
Crickets all the way through.
Yeah. Tweet, tweet.
She's just loading them all up on a playlist and let them go right on down the line.
So is Dan, Bin Rev is still streaming?
Yeah. We're streaming on it tonight.
I had trouble connecting to them last week.
They didn't like us.
Rejected.
Damn them all. Damn them all to hell.
You okay there, Dan?
No.
You guys ever see Busted Tees? It's pretty funny, man.
Busted what?
Busted Tees, the T-shirts.
Nope.
I'll put a link up. It's really funny. They have one of the shirts is Pedro lacks political experience.
Must be one of them things you have to be there to get.
Dan previewing the music while the show's still going.
Yeah.
Yep.
Might as well just play it if you're going to do that.
Yeah, really.
No,
close your eyes and pick something, Dan. Don't worry about it.
I am going to pick. I have something right here. I just wanted to make sure.
Eeny, meeny, miny, suck.
Some of these shirts are really funny.
Shirts from where?
Busted Tees.
Oh yeah, that's a great site. Busted Tees are really good. I have this down in just a minute. Chaka chaka. I'll just sing into the microphone for the next 5 minutes.
No.
Chugga chugga. Chugga chugga. La 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 la. Nobody ever talks about OpenSUSE or SUSE Enterprise anymore on this show.
We're waiting for your review, Dan.
I figured Pat
I did a review of SLED 10 Service Pack 1 I did on my blog a while back.
Yeah, the words a while back are included there.
Hey, listen, man. Some of us have lives, all right?
Mm-hmm. What is this life you speak of?
It keeps me busy.
Lies, all lies.
It's about seven months old, and it's screaming to be fed.
Mine seems to, like, consist of driving on 78 for, like... I think I figured it out. In, like, the last 18 years, I've spent, like, over a year on 78 in terms of hours. It's really, really sad.
You've added up all the hours that you spent sitting in your car driving back and forth to work?
Yeah, just general, you know, figuring 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, 18 years. It's sad that pops into my head while I'm driving. It makes driving that much worse.
Long good time.
You know, I've always been interested to try out Fedora again, but then I say, why? I've never been happy with RPMs-based distributions, and I know Fedora's probably phenomenal. You know, that and Mandriva, I've sometimes had an itch to see how that they've gone. And, you know, I should probably just call up Randy Kramer and say, hey, how's Mandriva? And he's probably still running 7.0 or something.
Probably, yeah.
Do you guys still go to the LUG meetings? Alan, Pat?
A little far away from me.
Yeah, I know you know.
I didn't go last month.
Yeah, last month I didn't go either. I don't think there was a meeting last month.
Well, there's always a meeting. We just never bothered to put it down. I think the calendar puts it down for the second Tuesday of every month or second Saturday of every month, but...
Yep.
I didn't...
Well, I definitely plan on going next month. The next meeting I'm going to go to, I think.
Next month is like a week and a half away.
Yeah.
Only.
Yeah. I'll have to fire it up in a virtual machine. Been itching to try VirtualBox.
Yeah, VirtualBox is pretty sweet, man. I've been playing around with it.
Yeah, I need to get my act together and do that. As well as doing some other crap. I read the second book in the Looking Glass Wars trilogy. Really fantastic. Seeing Red was a fantastic book. I highly recommend it. Soon to be a major motion picture.
That good, huh?
Yeah, it was really good. Looking Glass Wars was phenomenal. If you like Alice in Wonderland. Good stuff. Well, I do have music. Should I play us out?
Play us out.
What the hell?
Another one. Piece of crap show. No, actually, it was a good show. It was great. Great guests tonight. We've been having a lot of great guests. And,
I don't know. What do you guys think about doing a listener call-in episode on December 26th?
Oh, did our other plans fall through?
Well, we... That's not definite, so I should follow up with them and see what they want to do. If they don't want to do that, we could do a listener call, and we haven't done one in a while.
No, we haven't. We could do that. I'm down with that. Our listeners like that. You know,
my only concern is that Dave Yates guy hogs the phone.
Oh, dude, when he gets on, he just don't shut up. He calls up, and oh my God, it's like... He just feels like he's got free rein on our show, just like he's driving down the highway. Nobody else there with him. Just buds right in.
Well, he is getting invited to all these different shows, so.
He's a celebrity now.
Moving on up the food chain.
We'll have to have him on our show so that people will come and listen to our show.
No one ever invites us.
Whatever happened to Chess Griffin? He never shows up anymore, too. He was on
I don't know, man. He's hiding out. I heard something. Maybe he got into legal troubles or something like that.
I think he was looking to move when I talked about a high Linux.
Right?
Wait, isn't he a lawyer? He can't get into legal troubles.
Lawyers get in trouble.
No, wasn't he on, like, I think he was on our chat maybe a couple shows ago.
I don't know. He was on that Fresh. You know, it's like the Fresh Ubuntu has this...
tonight.
This nice little round table, and then nobody ever comes back to our show again.
Mm-hmm.
Dan, they're just creeped up by you, that's all.
That's it, huh? Dun, dun, dun. Alrighty.
People scared to come back on our show because they, you know, they run out of their canned material too fast. Then they have to talk about real stuff.
And reality sucks, right?
That's it. I have a Jonathan Colton song, 1st of May. Probably not work safe. I think if I recall, it might have some inappropriate language in it. So just be careful. Turn it off now. If that's it, gentlemen, I will play us out.
That's it for me. Good night, everybody.
Have a good
one. That's it. See you next week.
All right. Take it easy.
Good night.
I'm sick and tired of wind, and I wish that it was spring. Then a little fella named Robin Redbreast began to sing. And he sang, ooh, child, what'd you think of cold winter's gonna last forever? Ooh, child, now's the time for all the people to get together. Starts today, so bring your favorite lady, or at least your favorite thing. Water's not cold, baby, dip in your victim. Maybe I'll see you in flagrante delicto. Grass below you, sky above. Celebrate spring with a crazy little thing called fucking outside. For the information, I cried a little when he flew away. I watched an episode of the People's Court and I tried to plan my day. I called up my old lady, she wasn't home, so I called my girl. I asked her if she'd like to join me as I entertain the world. And I said, ooh, child, a blanket and I promise I will brush the ants off. Ooh, child, you're gonna like it when we're taking each other's pants off outside. Cause it's the 1st of May, outdoor fucking starts today. So bring your favorite lady, or at least your favorite thing. Water's not cold, baby, dip in your big toe. Maybe I'll see you in flagrante delicto. Grass below you, sky above. Celebrate spring with a crazy little thing called fucking outside. So we went to the park together. We were walking in the midday sun. We met all kinds of people and we fucked everyone. We fucked the lady who sells ice cream. We fucked a man with a tan sharp head. Everyone who needed fucking, well, they got fucked today. So come on, ooh, child, open your mind and your heart. Feel the spirit moving through you. Ooh, child, you feel the warmth of the love when I stick it to you. Cause it's the 1st of May, outdoor fucking starts today. Bring your favorite lady, or at least your favorite thing. Water's not cold, baby, dip in your big toe. Maybe I'll see you in flagrante delicto. Grass below you, sky above. Celebrate spring with a crazy little thing called fucking outside, fucking outside, fucking outside. looking outside.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
Yeah, it's over.